Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Exposed Vet, Haddit.com Veteran Podcast. Exposed Vet has teamed up with Haddit.com to bring you in-depth information about all issues affecting today's veteran. Now, here's your host, John and Gerald.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of the Exposed Vet Podcast. Today is the 17th day of March, 2022. Post-COVID, of course. People say COVID's about over with, so we're going to hopefully take the word for it. And I'm still going to wear a mask in some places. Co-host today is Mr. Gerald Cook out of the great state of Missouri. How you doing, Gerald?
Doing okay, John. Happy to be here. Getting ready for a thunderstorm here. Going to hit us pretty soon. But other than that, it's been a pretty nice day.
Well, when we get as boogered up as we are, we can't say happy to be here. We have to say lucky to be here.
Well, yeah, you got a point there. I guess you're right.
Yeah, I don't think it. Today,
more of a miracle.
Today, we're going to do an in-depth interview with Dr. Bash. Dr. Bash is a veteran medical advisor. He does independent IMOs and IMEs for vets that have claims in the appeals process for wherever they're at. He does examinations. He does a lot. He's been doing it for a long time. How you doing, Dr. Bash?
I'm good.
Good.
Yeah,
we got the team.
I was always trying to start out a little bit with what happened this week in the world of the in the high level review and the world of the DVA, because I do one or two of those a week, you know. So I was doing a high level review this week, and I was on the phone, you know, with the patient. I go as expert witness, and for all the veterans out there, make sure when you do your high level reviews that you go down the list of items that are in your file. So we're going down the list of items. I want to make sure my Nexus letter was in there, because you can't add new information in the high-level review. So we looked for my Nexus letter, and, you know, the lady there, she had been like 20 years, and so she used to work in the admin part, got out of politics, went back to the rating. So she's looking, she knows what she's doing. And the guy says, well, I sent it like in July. We looked in July. He said, well, we see your DBQs in July, and looking around, I can't find it. And so the patient had like about 10 issues, 10 DBQs. You know, it might be like 1,000 questions, right? And so maybe they took my Nexus letter and put it on the back of the DBQs when they sent it in. And she goes, yep, there it is. And so in the patient's decision, they never, ever mentioned my Nexus letter, because they never went all the way through the DBQs. They didn't know it was there. And so so I asked her, I said, well, can you relabel that? Can you relabel that title, that data point in the record? She says, yep, I can do that. And she relabels it as Dr. Bash DBQ. That was important, because the guy only had 3 or 4 issues for this high-level review, and he's going to come back around for the rest of the issues on the Nexus letter. And then the guy, same thing would happen again. The raters only have a couple hours. They're not going to go through those 1,000 questions and look for my 22-page Nexus letter on the end. So the moral of that story, so the moral of that story is, when you send, I think what I'm going to do now from now on, when the patients send their things in, they should send them in maybe separately. You know, send my Nexus letter separately, and then send in the DBQ separately, so they get, when they come in, and they get identified in the file as each separate thing, so they don't get mixed up that way.
That should make it easier. Make it easier for people to process it anyway. So, I mean, it's like you get a big stack of stuff, they're going to throw it in. Yeah.
Yeah, because I get a lot of cases now where they say they don't even mention my Nexus letter. I think the same things happen. I think it's buried in the big pile of paper. You know, you get 100 pages. My package Nexus letter, which could be, you know, 20 pages. And then we have DBQs, which could be another 100 pages. And then we have like lay letters. I think Skip and Alice are on there today, but they help patients with lay letters. And those could be, you know, 10, 20 pages. And then you have maybe my resume, and you have some medical records. So you can easily get a 100-page package. And it all goes in together. It's kind of a big thing for somebody to sort through, and also for how to label. Like, how do you label that? You know?
Yeah, and I'd say be careful. Yeah. of information on both sides of the page, because I've seen that to be really problematic.
Oh, both sides of the page, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Sometimes they just copy one part, don't get the back side, right?
That's exactly right. That's happened to me before.
Yeah, me too.
I had a guy today, same thing. He said when he got out of service, he's out processing, and one of the guys that was helping pulled pages out of his record and gave him copies of it because information was on both the front and the back side. And oftentimes when they do now, when they process, they just copy one side of the record. So that's an important point, Gerald, right? That's an important point.
And you hang on to them records like they're the most important things in the world.
Yeah, records.
Serious, hang on to them. Do not lose. Yeah, they're important.
One
so
page,
the evidence
was closed. Yeah, veterans go, yeah, in my field, radiology, we talk about old films. Old films make you smart because it's old comparisons. But the record's like one page. One word, one letter on one page can make the whole difference in your case. Hypo versus hyper, one lab value that's high or low, all that stuff can make a big difference.
Yeah, that's important. You guys, if you file a claim issues like that, you better make sure you have your x-rays and your disc or whatever, because if you see Dr. Bass again at IMO, he probably wants to look at them, especially the
reports. Yeah. So I've talked before, about how the x-rays, when I worked in DCVA, you know, they had we had 11 or 12 radiologists, and they only let one guy read the x-rays for the ratings. And that guy was, like, reading them all normal. I said, I want to see what's going on here, because I was doing some reading stuff back then. He said, no, you can't do that. He's in a room. He locks the door. He can't see. And so I go back later and read the films, and they're all, a lot of them are abnormal. So the VA's having, certain types of docs in different parts of the hospitals read things out normal for the ratings instead of being abnormal to help the case. So those old records are good because I can relook at those x-rays. I do that, especially the ones that are normal. The ones that are abnormal, I'm not so worried about for the rating part because the VA doesn't, it's not graded based on how bad they are. But the ones that are normal make a big difference because that this is a normal data point.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had a guy this week. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Keep going, Dr. Bass.
Yeah. I had a guy this week that was a football player at the Naval Academy. And he, was free safety, did a lot of tackles with his head up, and he was evaluated and told he couldn't play football anymore because his back was bad. But his x-ray showed he had these things called pars fractures, which are little support structures in the back, and he had bilateral pars fractures. And his x-rays are normal along the way, supposedly, but they reread they're abnormal. So that's common. That's a common thing to have happen. That a lot of times films are read normal and they're not normal. Error rate.
Free safety. Yeah. Free safety is hitting, man.
Exactly. That's the hit of attack. because even the radiology miss rate, radiologists miss, we're not perfect, so the miss rate is there too, so you can reread them and even make an error, even not if it's not on purpose, it can still be an error.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing is about the BVA. So I did a BVA case this week, and so go to the BVA hearing, and the judge goes, we had like four issues, and I said, well, look at this letter I want to put in, like we used to always do, and this was under the rapid appeals management. And he says, we can't add new information during the BVA hearing in the RAMP program. I said, I thought you could do that. And he goes, well, it's a little bit tricky. He says, you can't add it in before the hearing, but all hearings now are automatically open for 90 days afterwards. And he says that afterwards then you can add new information in that 90-day window. I said, well, that's a little bit confusing. He said, it's kind of a little tricky thing there because most veterans don't know that that's the way it works. So what we did is we had a hearing. I read from my Nexus letter and described all the different issues for the judge. And the judge had some questions. And so after the hearing, we submitted my old report, the one I'd made for the hearing. And then after the hearing, I submitted another write-up, a little addendum that addressed his issues that were in the hearing. So we're able to get new information in. So that's just word of the wise for veterans. Take your information to the hearing, or if you have the hearing, make sure you add any of the new information you have in 90 days, and then you can get it in the record that way. It's kind of a little weird because the judge doesn't know what to talk about it, but at least you get it in the record.
And now when you pick a veteran up, for example, you do his Nexus and things like that, and you kind of help him. I mean, you'll stay with him until he's done, right? You didn't go to BBA with him.
Yeah, right. Yes, I'm doing. Yes, I'm doing. Yeah. Yeah. So I go. So I stay with him all the way through. So, you know, I usually go, you know, intent to file, and we do 526EZ with my Nexus letter. And then I usually go up to the high-level review that way and do that that expert witness at the high-level review, talk about what the mistakes he made. And then if that fails, then we go supplemental claim and then to the BVA, so I follow him through that way. Sometimes it's supplemental claim, we need new information. We need new information, so I might do a new DBQ, or I might call in some of my buddies to do new DBQs or new Nexus letters or opinions and things like that, so we can add new information to the record to help support, you know, or maybe we can object to or critique some other of the medical opinions by nurse practitioners. I call them nurses and assistants, nurse practitioners, assistants, physician assistants, because they're not physicians. Yeah. They really shouldn't be, you know, and shouldn't really be doing these cases, in my opinion, because they're way too complicated for their training level. You know, a lot of them get pretty good in their specialty. A lot of times in medicine, it's more complicated than that. So, like today, I had another case. This guy's a crazy case. The guy has, you know, he's in service. He's at a bunch of bases in Barksdale Air Force Base. And then he goes in, he's getting blood pressure, and his blood pressure is kind of a little high, down. And they're calling it white coat blood pressure. Then he goes along, you know, which is kind of has to do with stress and being afraid to go to the doctor and needle sticks and stuff like that. And he goes along and he gets a stroke. He gets a basal ganglia bleed in his brain, which is a blood pressure bleed in a lot of cases.
Uh-huh.
So he has his blood pressure bleed, left side, right side paralysis. His blood pressure is like 240 over 100, way, way high systolic, and his diastolic is not crazy high. And so then he gets evaluated outside, testing's all normal, and they say that his homocysteine level is high. And so, but they don't know. They say homocysteine level is high. That probably, Air Force evaluation, they said that probably caused your stroke. We don't know why. They said maybe because you're jogging too much and your blood pressure is high. So they wrote off his blood pressure to jogging or to white coat. And along the way, somewhere in there, he had some liver enzymes that were elevated. You know, so it's the old elephant. You know, the elephant in the room, where the blind man feels the elephant, and he feels the trunk, and then somebody feels the tail, and he thinks it's a rope, and the other guy feels the leg and thinks it's a tree or something like that, you know. And so this is the same sort of thing. He keeps seeing all these different doctors, and they say that he has, you know, elevated liver enzymes. We don't know why. His blood pressure is kind of high. We don't know why. He has a stroke. We kind of know that maybe it's homocysteine caused it. We don't know what caused that, you know. So I said, well, you know, I've been at this a while. I think, I was on the phone. I was talking to him. I started doing some research on the phone. Looked up homocysteine, and then I looked up. I said, "Well, let's just see if toxins cause a lot of problems. Let's look at toxins and see if Barksdale is on the Superfund. Barksdale Air Force Base. That's where it was. It's on the Superfund site. And then, so that's good. So that means you probably had some trichloroethylene that was exposed to. And then, so I looked up trichloroethylene and homocysteine. Yep, trichloroethylene causes homocysteine through hepatitis." And then I looked up homocysteine, and yep, that caused blood pressure. And then that caused the whole story is, you know, bad water at Air Force Base, bad water with TCE caused hepatitis caused homocysteine causes blood pressure spike. By the way, it causes systemic, and then blood pressure causes stroke, and he's got stroke paralysis. So, I mean, that took like all my effort, my experience, and my training, and my research to find that. And, you know, nurse practitioners, PAs aren't going to do that, you know. So that's the kind of stuff that helps.
That's why you go to med school.
Yeah, that's right. And do these cases. I mean, it takes, just come out of med school, you got to have some experience behind you. So back to the BVA. So I asked the judge at the BVA, I go, he tells us, he says, you don't know this, but I'm not going to be the same judge writing this up. What do you mean? He says, well, this is going to go into the queue, and I might be the same judge, but I might not be the same judge. You go, well, I said, wait a second. We're going to go to a hearing with you, and then you're going to ask questions and all this kind of stuff, and then you're not going to be the one that decides it. He says, probably not. And so I said, the notes you make are going to go to the new judge, right? He goes, yeah, if I make any notes. I said, well, can you make some notes so the new judge has an idea what's going on at this hearing? Because otherwise the hearing is kind of in a way, you know, useful.
When they When did they start that?
Well, that's, see, this is all the stuff that's secret because I, you know, he said that's the new ramp system. That's the way it works in the ramp system inside the VBA. So that's what I'm telling you, because it's new stuff I'm gathering as I do these cases. You know, as I testify, I always ask these questions to kind of understand the process. And nobody knows that. Nobody understands that. But that's the way it is. So, you know. So, that's, you know, I told him, make sure you make notes. Make sure you make some notes and give it to the new judge, because that's not really, it's not really fair to the patient, because, you know, you're here and you get the body language and you get the emphasis of the patient's, you know, symptoms and how they describe things. And that's why the hearing is in person, so you have that extra information. And the new judge is not going to have that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Now, those changes are coming hot and heavy now.
What's that?
Those changes are coming hot and heavy now. A lot of Federal Register type changes, you know, the ratings for tinnitus and sleep apnea and crap like that. So,
yeah. Well, we got a new administration. You know, every time you have a new administration, things change in the VA. So, you know, for better or worse, but there's always a wave of new ideas and people think they can do it better, you know, faster, quicker, cheaper, whatever.
Yeah.
So, So I can tell you guys. A funny story. Okay, so you're going to interview me about my history, but I'll give you a lead in.
Yep.
So, both my brothers are pilots in the Air Force, right? And my little brother has gone through command and retired as a higher level general officer. But anyway, so along the way, somewhere along there, he's taken over an Air Force base in Charleston, South Carolina. And so we go down for the change of command ceremony. We're there, my mom and dad are there, my other brother there. The Air Force base, you know, we go in the hangar, and the hangar is, like, perfectly clean. It's probably a brand-new paint job, you know. My brother says it's probably cleaner than your kitchen floor, my older brother. Pretty clean, you know. So we go in there, you know, and they had the ceremony, and they had a little formation. The guys standing at attention, there were pilots standing there, and then, you know, maybe about 20 of them. And then my brother's doing a little talk, and they're standing. And then one guy falls out of formation. Falls down, hits his head on the concrete. Boom. And my little brother's still talking, you know, just kept talking. And along come these little pallbearers, you know, ran out there with a litter, scooped him up on the litter and drug him off, you know. I go, like, what just happened? This is crazy. And then 20 years ago, like 6 months ago, this guy comes to me, you know, doing my cases. And he comes to me and he goes, I got a head injury in service. I said, what happened to you? He says, I'm a pilot, and I was in formation. I fell out and hit my head. What? I go, were you at Charleston Air Force Base? Yeah. I said, well, I was in the audience when it happened. Is that like, you know, I know your brother. So then I go, what happened to you? And he goes, well, they took me to the day room. What do you mean they took me to the day room? I'm a pilot. I'm not going to the hospital. Forget that. You know, I won't be able to fly anymore. So I took him to the day room, you know, shook it off, whatever. No record, no nothing. And he goes, you know, can anybody talk? Nobody's going to talk about that. Forget it. We're all pilots. You know, nobody's going to document it. So I was there. I could witness it happen. You know, so I ended up being the witness and the IMO Nexus letter writer.
Talk about right place and right time.
So funny.
I mean, yeah. Your mother would be very proud of her boys, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, rest in peace, Granny. But so the other thing, might as well talk about another story. You know, we got these pilots. I've got like four cases. I probably have four cases on my desk right now, pilots with bad necks. And so as it turns out, you know, I've seen some of the worst necks in these pilots recently in these MRI scans.
Navy.
There's a nice article out. Yeah, well, Navy, Air Force, any pilots, you know, helicopter, all those guys. They all have bad necks. And so there's nice articles now that come out that talk about G-forces and, you know, stresses the Z-forces in the Z-plane. And then, but they have bad, bad necks. I mean, they have, you know, quadriplegia even, you know, hands bad, can't walk, fall down. Guys in their late 60s, 70s. And it turns out those jets, you know, after the F-100, the Century Series on, the jets are able to sustain high G-forces more than they were in World War II. Even the World War II guys, you know, 4, 5, 6 Gs, you know, instantaneous. Jaegers hit 7 Gs. But these, you know, these F-15s are 9 Gs. And even the A-10, I got a guy with A-10. He's, you know, 5, 6 Gs. So.
Warthog. Okay.
Yeah. And even a couple of years of that kind of stuff. And then, you know, and they also get lumbar spine. Besides cervical spine, they get lumbar spine. So I got some other guys on my desk that are, you know, lumbar spine with the ruptured disc down there. And the cervical looks like a lot of osteophytes, you know, disc disease with osteophytes growing. The lumbar spine is more plain disc disease. You know,
that's bone spurs, folks.
What's that?
Bone spurs, folks.
Yeah, bone spurs and osteophytes. Yeah, osteophytes. Yeah.
Can
so,
give them gel-filled seats or something where it wouldn't be so hard on them?
What was that, Gerald? What was your question?
Gel-filled seats.
Yeah, gel-filled. That's a good idea. You know, the problem is the gel might get you for the first bump, you know, like if you're on a bumpy road, but this is sustained, you know, G-forces over, you know, many seconds.
Yeah, over and over.
Right.
Well, look at the Navy pilots. I mean, you set your butt in an F-14 or F-18. They hook your plane up, put your harness on you, and then they can do your control checks. Next thing you know, you got wide open throttle, and you go from 0 to 180 in less than 2 seconds.
Right, whiplash. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the helmet. The helmet weighs like 5 pounds, you know. And if you have 9 Gs, that's 9 times 5 is like 45 pounds. That's like a bag of dog food on your neck, you know, back and forth. So, and the Navy guys land hard on the carriers. They get lumbar spine problems, you know, control crash. So, yeah, so all that stuff is high, and we're seeing more and more. The point is that, you know, these jets are more and more high performance, and so these pilots. You know, these pilots now, they're in their 70s, are the first guys coming through with all these problems because they're kind of leading edge, you know, 50 years later of the issues they had with their 20s. Top Gun kind of stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Big rash. Yeah, big rash of more neck disease and back disease.
Yeah, I've seen it all, Dr. Bash.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of it.
There's an association out there about some kind of association of fighter pilot neck disease, something like that.
Yeah, they're all gung-ho when they're young, you know. They want to stay flying, so they won't say much. Because that's flight surgeons are enemy, you know what I mean?
So my dad...
Go ahead, Doctor.
Yeah, my dad was in World War II, you know, World War II P-51 fighter pilot. You know, Brown Shoe Air Force, came through, you know, Army, drafted, and... So that was, what's the deal with doctors? The troublemakers. There's nothing they can do good for you. That's even his pilot from day one, Air Force. You know, and he thought, had the same idea those guys from. You know, so it's been around a long time.
I'm just glad he had a P-51 as the best plane ever made, prop plane.
Yeah, it's a pretty crazy plane. He used to talk about his 9-hour missions over Japan. You know, back. You know,
escort B-29s over Japan.
Yeah, and also dropped bombs.
Did some
aerial combat, you know, at home with gas, make it home. So,
yeah, he worked for Doolittle then, didn't he?
Yeah, he said he was there the day that when they signed the armistice after the war, they took all the planes, and he said he was flying over, because he used to strafe and drop bombs in Japan. And Chichijima, you know, but he said that he was in the air the day they signed all that, because they had the whole sky full of airplanes.
Oh, they had, like, I forget how many they had, but yeah. It's on video.
Yeah, we was there with that.
Yeah, it's on video.
Yeah, real deal.
So, Dr. Bash, explain to us what made you decide to be a doctor, and give us a kind of a general... And med school and military, going to your institute while you're at it.
Yeah, so I started out, grew up in a little logging town in Northern California, and you know, I had good grades. I took some kind of a science test, and I guess I got the best score. And then what they did in these little towns, they said people with a high score on the science test can go down, and we'll take you down to Davis, Sacramento, and watch heart, get you down heart surgery. So I got to go down and watch heart surgery on a dog, replace a valve and stuff like that. So that was pretty cool. And then my neighbor in town used to work for my dad, and his son was an orthopedic surgeon, so I went and watched him do some surgeries in Reno. I thought that was pretty cool. And then early on, my uncle's a chiropractor, and I was a little kid, you know, in the woods. I shot a bird with a BB gun, you know, and it wasn't dead yet. And my uncle picked that bird up and tried to do, like, CPR and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on the bird, you know, still warm. So I thought that was pretty cool, you know. So I think kind of a combination of all that stuff. And, you know, like, you know, grades were good enough that it seemed to be that was a reasonable pathway to go, because I could take the test and get scores that allowed me to move forward. So did that. And then with the Air Force Academy, when I went there, they made us sign something after Vietnam. We started in 74, 75, and that was the war was ending. They made us sign some papers so we couldn't go to medical school because they had a surplus of docs after the war. And then before I graduated, there was a whole bunch of us, you know, class 79, just like about, I don't know, 10 or 15 of us, that we all were able to move into medicine pathway because they then had a shortage because the docs all left service. And so we all did our basic biochemistry and enough to take the MCATs. And it's amazing. Most of those guys, you know, 15 of those guys are all either veterinarians or doctors, DOs, all of us basically got into med school. So that was pretty good. I went to the Uniform Services Medical School in Bethesda. And so there, you know, I was a sports guy, so I was playing sports, and I broke my neck playing rugby as a fourth-year student, and then went to a VA hospital. This is how I got into the veteran stuff. So it was VA hospital. I spent 6 months there and then rehabbed myself and came out and was able to scrap my way through medical school to finish. And then my neck case took 7 years to process, and my doctor in the med school had to write 5 letters for me. So Dr. Oster is my role model in what I do because he was so helpful to me. And he was MD-JD, so he knew the law. I got the laws for him, but he knew how to put together in a letter. And so him and I worked on that together and we were able to get my thing, you know, it took 7 years. And so that's probably why, you know, I do this, because I feel for the veterans. You know, I'm one of those guys. I'm one of those guys that got run over by the VA. And my case took forever to get processed. And, you know, it's hard to do. Even as a doc and the system with the MD-JD helped me write letters, it took a lot to get that happen. So I did finish med school, and I did some training. I did radiology at George Washington, D.C., and then popped out of there and went to patch reservation for a couple of years and worked there, and then came back to D.C. and did research work and shock trauma in Baltimore, and got into research in NIH, and that's where I did all the MRI scan stuff. I worked with the guy who built the first MRI scanner, and his boss, Dr. Frank, was the guy who worked on the first MRI scanner, and his boss, Dr. Latimer, got the Nobel Prize. So I was working like one guy off the Nobel Prize, and I came from a little logging town in Northern California with, you know, 2,500 people in it. So that was quite the transition for me to see how that all worked. And then out of there, I went and worked a little bit, and Laurel was another radiologist in a wheelchair for a couple of years, and then that's when all those changes were happening. He couldn't really afford to pay me, so I went down and started working with paralyzed veterans. And I worked there for 3 years with Gordon Mansfield, and I worked in basically it was a PVAIG team. We used to take nurses and doctors and go on site visits to the hospitals and check on quality care for the paralyzed veterans in the centers, and then we'd write reports. Our reports went right to the Secretary of the VA and all the chiefs of the services like medicine and pharmacy, and we interfaced with those guys to try and make it better. So that gave me a view of how the VA works on the outside, and I talked to all the doctors in the field, and I got an idea how the pressures the doctors had, what they could do and what they couldn't do. Along with my training, when I was a resident in radiology, I did a lot of training at the VA in D.C., so I had, you know, I had patient exposure, I had D.C. exposure, and I had, you know, executive supervisor exposure across the whole VA, so I have a good perspective on how all that fits together and, you know, how those pieces are biased or not biased against or for the veteran as far as the claims go. Mm-hmm.
How did you get started in the business right now?
Yeah, so I was Yeah, I was at the PDA, and I was doing those site visits. You know, I'm kind of a high-energy guy, so at lunchtime, I was kind of bored. And back in the day, there was a guy named John Cain that was worked in the VA for years and helped write the rules, a lot of the congressional rules that he wrote inside the VA. The Paralyzed Veterans hired him to work over in the BDA in the appeals division. So there was John Cain, and then his sidekick was Bill Krieger. And so back in the day, that was 95, 96, 94, back in that day. So John Cain knew that Krieger was doing cases, and he knew I was, and he thought maybe I could help Bill with the medicine part of the cases. And so John put us two together to work on cases, basically. And so what John would do is at lunchtime, he'd bring cases from the BVA over to the Paralyzed Veterans, about three blocks. He'd bring cases over. I don't think you're supposed to take cases out of the BVA. He'd take cases out of the BVA and bring them over to my desk, and we'd look at them, And then pretty soon I started taking my wheelchair. I pushed down. It was like three blocks. I'd go down there, and I'd start doing cases at lunchtime when I wasn't on field trip, So I'd go in there and start doing cases for these guys. And then when I was doing that, I was in the BVA, and you go down the hallway of the BVA, and there was the American Legion, and you see American Veterans, and NAM Vets, and VFW. And so I used to go down the hallway and stick my head in the door and see if they had any cases to do. And so I was doing cases for everybody over there. And then, that's where I got those cases on my – I have a little chart we'll talk about in a while probably. It's a chart, and it shows, my cases were 100% win rates. Bill Krieger and I had 100% win rates for three or four years in a row when we first started up in 96, 7, 8, 9.
And so, that was before the VCA too, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it was back in the days. They passed a law in the early 90s that the VA could take outside medical opinions. And so that was John Cain knew that, so he saw me over there, and that's why he brought me over, because he could use them. And so I'm probably one of the first guys that wrote opinions. Bill said the Jewish American Veterans had a guy that was bringing some doctors and usually psychiatrists that were getting opinions. So I'm probably the first medical doctor. I'm probably the only medical doctor that's testified. I've testified like 100 times at the Board of Appeals. I don't know of any other medical doctor. I know some psychiatrists who go once in a while. But I'm not afraid of that, because I was in the BVA building. I was right there where the judges were. Krieger took me into cases. I went into cases, and so it was kind of my whole training program that I understand how it all works and the value of it. So that's how I got started. Bill Krieger, John Cain.
Yeah, well, Cain's still around, or is he?
He passed.
Yeah.
And he was, in the early 90s, he must have been about 90.
Bill Krieger's still here, believe me.
Krieger's going. Bill's going to bring him to Davies. He's kind of bogged down with some cases. He's got a couple of big ones we're working on. But, Bill Krieger's good.
Okay. So you've got a website, Veterans Medical Advisor.
Yep. veteransmedadvisor.com.
Okay.
veteransmedadvisor.com. And you can find me, Craig Bash. You can Google that. And then I think we've got Skip and Alice on here, too. And Skip and Alice are my assistants. And I'll give you – Skip's number is always good for calls. So I'll just put that in here. It's 925-381-7561 if you need Skip. And he can call, make a set-up appointment with me, and I can talk to you the next day or a couple of days down the road. 925-381-7561. And then Alice is in there.
I'm just glad to hear you went to all these schools. Your mom told me that you just hung around the drugstore for a long time.
Well, the drugstore had a soda fountain, and the girls go to the soda fountain, so I was just hanging out there.
Yeah.
I don't think that was medical research, though. I think that was personal.
I got a question the other day that, how many times can I resubmit a claim before I must appeal to the BVA?
I heard there may be there may be some more data, but so you get one chance at the high level review, but if you keep putting in new evidence at the supplemental claim level, I think that I don't know if there's a limit. Maybe there is one, but I don't know. I think it's It's kind of, you can keep doing as many times as you want if you keep having the information.
As long as you keep the claim open. As long as you keep the claim open and every time, you know, within a 1 year period, don't let it die. You should be okay.
Right.
But if it dies, you know, you got to have new and relevant evidence to get your claim reopened.
Oh. So 364 days, skip 364 days, just keep putting in new evidence and just keep bouncing it open. It's kind of, you know, they don't want garbage evidence, and you keep putting too much, they might, you know, call it garbage. But if you have good, you know, new good evidence, like a lot of times I get a new x-ray maybe, or I get a new lab test, or like I said, I get new consultants, right? Skip and then make those guys can all be new evidence.
You get a new opinion that's strong.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, take sleep apnea, for example. Say you're a service record for heart disease and lung disease. You filed a claim for sleep apnea many, many years ago, and they didn't have a claim. Well, you get another opinion from a doc if you're doing another sleep study, and he says, you've got AFib, your sleep apnea will aggravate or will do material evidence.
Then that aggravation is an important point. It makes it worse. You know, a lot of people forget about aggravation. And then what I'll do, in that case, Skip, what I'll do is if it says Dr. Smith, then I'll say Dr. Smith put a new letter in, and I agree with Dr. Smith for these reasons. And that way you have kind of two medical opinions piled on top. And that makes it hard for the VA because the VA's got to go find two medical opinions to go against those two opinions. Or three maybe, that's true, right? Yeah. So in order to get equal, if they have three opinions, it's, you know, maybe greater equal poise. To get three doctors, to get three doctors to agree on anything is kind of impossible.
Okay. So now, your process is basically this. You know, the patient's wanting to contact you to get an IMO and IME, then it's his best interest to go ahead and call Skip and set up an appointment with you, and you'll set the appointment up, and you'll call the patients yourself. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep, I give them a call. Sometimes, you know, it's like a doctor. My mornings are like a doctor clinic visit. You know, sometimes I'm 15 minutes early, sometimes I'm 15 minutes late, but, you know, I give them a call on the phone and talk to them, ask them questions about what their rating is and what their disease is. And on the phone, I can kind of give them a guess, basically what their percent should be based on my experience, just from what they tell me. And then I get the records and do DBQs and work out the details. And then my letter is a draft letter in a Word document. And I usually send the patient as an open document in Word, and then they can add to it and edit in bold. And we go back and forth. That's a really important step because that's why the VA gets a lot of this stuff screwed up, because these patients have, you know, a whole lifetime of illnesses, and I'm talking to them for a while, and I read the records, but I might miss stuff. And so this way they can identify issues that they want to talk about specifically, and they can add details of things I might overlook or are important or not important. And I get the final word about as far as what gets filtered. And so that's a really important step that nobody ever does. And then, so my package is going to be a Nexus letter, that part we just talked about, and it's going to be DBQs for the issues that are appropriate. And then it's going to be, I want to say a word about DBQs for a second. So back to the BVA, I asked the BVA chairman or one of the BVA judges about DBQs because they got those new DBQs. And I said, what about the DBQs? And the BVA says, the judge says, we don't care what the doctor writes on toilet paper or new DBQ or old DBQ, we don't care. We want medical data. So, you know, the VA is going to start playing a game. They're going to say, oh, the DBQs are old, expired, or whatever. The BVA doesn't care. The BVA wants the data from the doctor. So my record, my Nexus letter, DBQs, and then we have to do a lay letter, which is basically a little travel log of the patient's life, what happened in service, what happened between, what happened now. And then something else I do a lot is I do testing. So I order tests all across the country, you know, federal service to the VA. I give the patient a little order. And they can take it to their doctor and get it reordered inside or outside the VA. So that new testing is important. We just talked about earlier about how x-rays can be negative, and so I'll repeat them or repeat sleep studies. By the way, home sleep studies are maybe, I don't know, 30% accurate. They're really bad. So if you have a home sleep study, you get a hospital one. And then what we'll do is we'll do my resume. And then a lot of times that testing will cause a new medical record to be generated. You go see a GI doctor, or a pulmonary doctor, cardiac for the stuff I order, and that doctor might generate a record. And actually going, there's new evidence. And that's where you get new evidence down the road, like what Skip was just talking about, new evidence for the supplemental claims. And then we'll attach maybe bits and pieces of the old record if we want, and that's where you get that 100 pages we're talking about.
Or 1,000.
Yeah, maybe a thousand.
Well, Dr. Bash, I'd like to say I've used one of your IMO and Nexus letters, and let me tell you, I was really quite impressed, and you did an excellent job, and furthermore, you even sat on a video court hearing with me, and I think that was a put the final nail in my ward, was being able to sit there and you personally face to face with the judge and telling them you know, the status of my condition and you know, what was the causes and how it all was tied in together, you know, proved up my nexus. And so that went an awful long way in supporting my claim, well, proving my claim up. And anyone that's needing a good, sound IMO, to do so, you're, as far as I'm concerned, you're the man to call, or the doctor to call.
That's a good lead.
Yeah,
good lead.
It's a great deal, a great service you're performing here for the veterans, and I would refer anyone to Dr. Bash here. He does a very professional job, and he has wonderful people working with him to help veterans. So it's worth your time, especially if you can have a video conference with the judge, and the judge is able to talk to him direct.
Well, thank you, Joe. That's an important point.
Yeah, that's an important point
because the a lot of the judges, and I know that Stacy can talk about, but a lot of the judges don't know me necessarily in person. I've testified a lot over the years. They switch around. So sometimes there'll be, you know, the judges think, oh, it's Dr. Bash. They don't know who this guy is or whatever. And so then if I go to your case and testify, then the judge sees me in action, you know, and he can ask me questions and understands where I'm coming from and what the basis for my opinion. So a few years back, I had a judge that I did a case for, and he came to me later on and did his own case because he thought I did a good job. So when I go to testify, those judges all start to learn about me, and then they can formulate their own opinion about my quality, and it helps a lot of the other veterans down the road, right?
Yes.
I did yours, and he sees what I did, and helps next time.
I got pre-approved because I asked permission to bring you on prior to the deal, so, you know, we didn't just shock the judge. Well, you have to have permission anyway, so when you get notice of a video hearing, just notify them. They give you a phone number that you'd like to have Dr. Bash to come on as an expert witness, you know, he's not your lawyer, but he is an expert witness, and he can opine right there on the spot. And that's very beneficial.
Well, Stacy knows about these ideas of, they call them questionable doctors, right, Stacy?
Oh, yeah. There's some kind of list floating around, folks, that I haven't seen a list. I think it's more or less a hit list or some kind of list people dig up and I guess they've had some issues with some docs in the past, and a couple of doctors' names on the list, but you know, the doctor's record has to speak for itself. You know, I mean, it's anytime you're successful and you keep cleaning people's clocks and you keep winning claims, somebody's going to come out with something negative because I guess they get tired of losing. I don't know what's going on or what happens, but it's crazy. Go ahead, Dr. Bash.
Yes, that list, we got that list, and the list has got 44 doctors on there, right? And so Now, I've been at this, we just talked about my history, and I've been at this like 25 years doing these cases. It's like every 4 or 5 years, there's a new administration, and then they come up with some new ideas, and they come at me. So one year they came at me 4 or 5 years ago, and the lawyers from the VA called up my medical school. I'm a professor, and they said, Dr. Bash works for the medical school. It's a federal medical school, and he can't do medical opinions. And, you know, and so he called the law office up, and the law office said, forget you guys. He's an adjunct professor here. It means he's not paid. He's doing volunteer work here, and he can write any medical opinion he wants to. That was happened one year. Next time they came around, when I was in the BVA building, I started hearing that there were emails about me being circulated around inside the BVA with the judges. And so I said, what? They said, yeah. So I got a Freedom of Information Act. This was like in 2009, a Freedom of Information Act, and I found out there was 18 emails that were circulating around about me in the BVA with the judges. So I went up to, that's why, Gerald, it's important for me to testify, so the judges get firsthand, right? So I went up to the BVA chairman, let's call him Chairman T. I go, Chairman T, like, what are these emails about me? What's going on? He says, come to my office. He calls me in his office, and he's in there with his deputy, and he goes, I don't like what you're doing. That's what he said to me. I don't like what you're doing. I said, are you part of these emails? You wouldn't answer. He said, I don't like what you're doing. I said, well, all I'm doing is writing medical opinions for veterans. And he goes, I don't like it. And I said, it really doesn't matter if you like it or not, because your judges love it, and I've got a 90% win rate. He goes, what? You have a 90% win rate? Yeah, I've got a 90% win rate. So if I'm such a bad doctor, or if I'm a questionable doctor, I'm not really a questionable doctor. I'm questionable because I have such a high success rate. That's why I'm questionable. So he goes, he asks his deputy, what's his rate win rate? And the guy says, we don't have those numbers. And then he kind of pissed at me. He said, get out of here. I don't talk to anyone. So that I have a win rate at the BVA. It's about 90% since 1996 in there when I first started with Krieger. And even during that time period when the BVA judges, when the chairman was circulating emails about how bad a doctor I was, my win rate didn't drop. I kept going right through it because the judges all based it on the facts, and I do, like we just talked about, the Nexus letter with research and literature and so. So over the years, I've gotten about 4 letters of apology from the VA. When I got a letter when they came at me from the medical school, and I got a letter from the Veterans Benefit Director over the years because they were writing stuff that I was a hired gun and biased, and he apologized for that and cleaned it up. And I got a letter from the Deputy Secretary of the VA, Gordon Mansfield. Now, I used to work for Gordon Mansfield at the PVA when I was doing those site visits, and so Gordon knew me for, you know, a decade. And then so when this BVA chairman told me that I don't like what you're doing, and the emails, I took those to Gordon. I said, Gordon, like, what's going on here? He says, I'll fix it. And so he wrote a letter of apology to me in 2009 before he left the VA assistant secretary. So my highest level of apology is from the deputy secretary of the VA. And so this new list just came out, I don't know, last week somebody told me about it. It's got 44 names on there. Now, I know a lot of those doctors on there because I've been doing cases for years. And so and you can do a ratio. Like if you look at my cases, I've done 600 cases at the DVA. If you multiply that times 10, that gives you 6,000. That's about the number I've done. So, for example, Dr. Anais is on that list, and he's done like 35 cases at the BVA last time I looked, and he's got about a 350 case log probably. And I know Dr. Gillette is on that list and a few other doctors. So I've actually reviewed those guys' work because the cases I do, they come to me for review as I do my work. And so I can tell you firsthand, those guys' letters are not fraudulent. They're not bad doctors. They're not questionable doctors. Those doctors do a lot of cases. And so I think that list is really just a list of doctors who do a lot of cases more than doctors that are questionable. So, you know, my firsthand experience is that, you know, we all have different levels. I've got a lot of experience, and I've learned a lot from Krieger about the law. And so, you know, my MOs are different than most, but we all have different levels of experience. And I don't think so far the ones I've reviewed are not bad letters. They're all just a little different, you know, different levels of expertise and experience probably is what it amounts to. Well, so hopefully I get a letter on the desk of the secretary right now. Maybe I'll get another letter of apology.
Maybe. There's a term I use when dealing with veterans claims. You know, you've got a lot of claims that pretty much slam dunk. The guy's going to win his claim. You know, he's one of them's got his evidence and he's got representation. There's a lot of claims that when they get off on off on the wrong foot. This is over long periods of time. I call them the Hail Mary claim because some people, you know, they've been denied so much, they know that they should win their claims, but the evidence is there, but it's processed very incorrectly. And the reason I call it Hail Mary is because I know Dr. Bash has done a couple of Hail Marys.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, Gerald's case, his is a very difficult case, and I have a lot of difficult cases come to me because I have a lot of experience, and sometimes I have a hard time with them. You know, Krieger and I do cases like that. We'll sit around and talk about a case for a couple of hours sometimes, trying to figure out how to get the medicine and the law together to make sense out of what's going on. You know, because part of the problem is there's 65,000 codes. I've said before, there's like 65,000 codes in medicine. The DRM is 2,000. So a lot of times the diagnostic code is wrong. The patient's got symptoms that are been worked up by nurses and assistants, and they've got the wrong diagnosis. And so that causes a huge problem, and it becomes a Hail Mary like you're talking about. You know, yeah, cases that are muddied down.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
complicated.
You got to iron it out. Yeah. You got to iron it out, Doc. I mean, that's all you can do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can win the claim, you got to iron. You got to, yeah.
Yeah. More testing. I get more testing. It helps me. The old records help me, right? The x-rays help me, and then I have consultants. I've got a Harvard doctor in D.C. I ask questions of, and he does backup opinions, and I've got other specialists around D.C. area where I was at for years that I use for as consultants because it's just like a regular clinic. You know, I can not know all of medicine, but I use my consultants to help me learn and, you know, help the patient.
Oh, okay. That's good. No, but, I mean, it's, you know, it's what it is. I mean, you've got a high success rate. You've been doing it for years. You have a lot of experience. You've been doing it, you know. I mean, you work with the BBA. You work with the Paralyzed Veterans of America. I could go across and get Dr. Bash's resume, but I don't think it's very long. Extremely long resume. But, you know, Dr. Bash does the opinions, and he has a lot of good help. And we said this to Mr. Krieger, Bill Krieger, is perhaps the smartest man that's ever had discussed the VA.
Yep, Bill Krieger, yep, you're right about that. He really understands it. Reads, you know, he's put a lot of hours in. He reads a lot and he studies, you know. Didn't just come to him. He's worked a lot over the years to get that level of expertise. And he's really a jewel to have around, you know.
Well, they say Bill knows football, but Bill knows VA.
So I asked Bill, I said, Bill, like, why were they giving me a hard time when we first started doing those opinions, you know, back to that judge, the chairman? He goes, well, you know, when you came along, you were kind of a thorn in their side. You know, he said the VA was always used to having medical opinions inside the VA, and you were an outside doctor. And so they really, it was like an ad abuse response. They didn't want you doing opinions, and that's where all that firestorm came from. And so it was Bill's perspective on the first decade. And then the next couple of decades, they're just getting tired of me winning so much. But a lot of judges really, it's not like that. There's administrators that don't like me because it costs them money and I win a lot. But a lot of the judges really appreciate what I do because I referee the opinion. Like if I go to Gerald's case and Dr. Smith said this and Dr. Jones said that, and I'll say I agree with Smith and I disagree with Jones, I'll go through and I'll referee the case all the way through the data and the medical opinions. And the judge loves that because he doesn't know, he can't get that data from his other doctors. He can't talk to them. And some of those doctors are biased. He knows they're biased, but he doesn't have the medical opinion to go against it, so he can't write the opinion. So Social Security, I do a lot of Social Security, and the same thing with Social Security. I mentioned that before. But so Social Security, I talked to a lady that did Social Security in Baltimore for 10 years. She had 3,000 cases. And I go, how do you do those cases? And she says, well, you use medical opinions. I said, how many of those cases do you see an outside medical opinion? She said, never. I said, 3,000 cases, never outside medical opinion. Nope. And so how do you get your medical opinion? He said, we send to our doctors. I said, who are those guys? Well, we give them $100 an hour, and they write negative opinions. And so the VA's got the same thing going on. They've got outside doctors, nurses, practitioners, and PAs and doctors under these contracts with OHI and QTC and those guys, and they're all writing VES and OHI. There's six or eight of them. But anyway, they're all writing negative opinions. Basically, they're getting paid by the company store, and they're, you know, John Brown used to see 80-90% negative opinions. It's about my experience. They're all mostly negative. So that's where I come in because I'm a counterbalance. And the judge appreciates that. The VA judges, I don't know about the Raiders as much. A lot of them do too, but the judges really appreciate because they dig in deep detail. So So Bill says they're getting used to me now, so he says, you know, 25 years later.
Gerald, your claim was a great one for an example, and I had a good question until you guys brought this out, and you pretty much answered that question. But, Dr. Bash, maybe you could just elaborate a little bit on why do the BVA judges often overturn decisions that have been claims that have been denied for 6-10 years when you get involved, Dr. Bash?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah. Well, so yeah, so Bill Krieger explained that to me because he said that, you know, the VA has the Veterans Health Administration and it has the Veterans Benefit Administration. And there's two sides to the VA, right? There's the medical care side and there's the admin side. And so all those raters out in the field work for the admin side, and that's where the M21 comes through. The M21 is not really a law. It's kind of a workbook guideline for the raters. They test them, and they use that as their guideline for doing ratings. They try and standardize it. But it's not necessarily correct, and it's not necessarily the law, and it has a lot of bias, political bias in it. So those cases will come up that way, and we work through that political bias. But when it gets to the BVA are judges, and they work directly line item for secretary. The BVA doesn't really care about Team 21. They don't really care about what the raters said. They don't really care about the other lower decisions. They make their own decisions based on the data. So that's your question, Alice. When I go to the BVA, then we get a fresh look at it, and it's based on the laws, and it's based on the medical record, and it's based on my opinion. And that's why the BVA judges can overrule and rule, and they don't have any quotas. They don't have any reason not to rule or rule against the lower court, basically the lower raters. They're independent. They make independent decisions. And so that's why we have such a high success rate there, because they're more fair.
Yeah, I think legal precedent sets in more to board.
They use the evidence at hand instead of trying to second guess or, for whatever reason, a lot of them raters, to me, seem to be biased. They think every veteran that files a claim is a gold digger. And
That's not a good scenario.
Are you saying
that they think all the veterans possess a bad case of malingering hypochondria, Joe?
Yeah.
Well, John Brown was on the show.
Killed him.
Yeah.
Remember our
buddy John Brown worked in the VA as a DRO for years, you know, and he thought that maybe 60% of the raters were evil. They actually don't like veterans. They don't think they should be getting benefits, like you're saying. And they work inside the benefit. Their boss, you know, who's your boss is who you work for, and their boss is the Veterans Benefits Administration. So that whole thing is in some ways biased. Even through the M21, it's biased because of the way they write that and the way they rate it. So you're right, Gerald.
Yeah, well, still
bias in there.
From a quality assurance standpoint, and I have this certificate. I can explain this. The Level 1 document is the Title 38, Part 4 for ratings. The M21 is just a Level B document. It cannot be admissible
right.
in any court of the law or anything. So.
Right. Right. So the BVA doesn't care about the M21. Right.
No, they don't. And the court doesn't either.
Exactly.
It's like locking
right,
a shot.
Right.
Get that out of here.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, we've got a minute left.
So, bottom line of that, to be persistent with your case, veterans, because if your case gets knocked down below, take it to the BVA because it's more fair.
We got a minute left. Let's get in contact with Mexican Dr. Bash. Skip.
Skip's on there. Skip's on the phone, but it's 925-381-7561. 925-381-7561. That's the best way to get me. He sits there for a time slot with you.
Yeah, they'll call you back. Okay, and you got Alice. She's your right arm.
Yep, Alice's assistant, major assistant. So,
okay.
She asked, both those guys are asking questions. Thanks for skipping off to ask questions. Good thing.
Yeah.
Thank you,
well,
Dr. Bash. It's nice to hear you on the radio again.
All right. Well, let's guess. Thanks for coming on, Dr. Bash. We'll do this again here next month or so. And, Gerald, thanks for coming on. And that's it for the show today, folks. This will be John and Gerald, half of Gerald Cook. We'll be signing off for now.
You've been listening to the Exposed Vet Podcast. All opinions expressed on the show are the opinions of the guest speakers and not necessarily the opinions of Exposed Vet, Haddit.com, or Blog Talk Radio. To leave a comment, send an email to exposedvet@gmail.com. Just put podcast in the subject matter. Tune in next week for another edition of the Exposed Vet Podcast. Thanks for listening.